We've got unfinished business with the Friday Special podcast. Early in the year, Helena had started a series of her art appreciation, art history, art criticism talks. The idea was to give her the Friday slot for several weeks running and let her get on with it. We made a start. Well, she made a start. And then the thing got derailed. Along came the Tourism Superstar competition, and I had to break off the start Helena had made, put her art appreciation series on hold. But as of today, it's no longer on hold, and we're going to do it properly. Start from the beginning and hold to our course. Hold to her course. Every Friday special for the next few weeks will be a Helena Art Appreciation podcast. They're progressive, they build. So it makes sense to start from square one and commit to showcasing them week by week, honoring the overall structure for the very good reason that it is a series, almost an art history and art appreciation course, and the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So the next few Fridays belong to Helena and her love of her subject. And maybe a brief word here about Helena. As she'll tell you in this introductory talk, she guided brilliantly for us for 11 years. Well, she doesn't say she guided brilliantly, but I'm telling you she did. And then we lost her to Cornwall. Now, in a sense, we've got her back, at least insofar as the podcast strand of our program goes. And we're hoping she'll be doing virtual tours before too long. Helena is an Oxford graduate. History and art were and are her subjects. She's a brilliant guide. They just don't come any better than Helena Jones. I'll just push out two stories here, which, combined, get her into focus. An American friend. He's a big deal in corporate America. The most successful American I know was in Helena's thrall. When he was in London, he'd always ask which walks she'd be doing during his stay. Christopher memorably said, "I could listen to that little blonde all day." Well, yeah, I know it's not politically correct, but it is what it is. It's the assessment of a high-powered, tack-sharp American executive who doesn't suffer fools, who doesn't have any time for waffle or anything less than the first rate. That was Christopher. Now me, David. I also am in thrall to Helena's art talks. I learn so much from them. And I now have done a lot of podcasts, getting on for 500 of them. 99 out of 100 times, I script mine and then record them. I assumed Helena was doing the same, because they're so well put together, she's so articulate, so assured, they're delivered so beautifully. My jaw dropped when she said, "No, I don't script them, I just do them." I'm still stunned, almost in a state of disbelief, certainly in a state of wonder and renewed appreciation. That's it. Every time I listen to her now, I'm aware, I'm thinking, she's doing this unscripted, off the cuff. That's a measure of both her command of her subject and the range and power of her mind. In academic terms, she'd be one of those rarities, an upper first. I've never asked her, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if she was an Oxford upper first. When you listen, just keep it in mind, she's doing this unscripted. It'll add to your enjoyment and appreciation. Okay, here's Helena, weighing anchor and setting sail on her latest Friday Special Art Appreciation course.
Hello, everyone, and a Happy New Year. It's Helena here in Truro. I was looking through an art book the other day when I came across the image of a painting which I'm very fond of, which I forever now associate in my mind with a walk which I used to guide for London walks on a regular basis, the old Marylebone Walk. I went to the London Walk's website and was delighted to find that the walk is still in the programme. Same meeting place, day and time. 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon at Bond Street Underground Station. So I thought I would record a podcast which talks a little bit about the walk, about the museum in which the painting is situated, and the painting itself, as well as a couple of other personal favourites of mine in the collection. Now, it doesn't surprise me in the least that the old Marylebone Walk is still in the programme. It's a super walk that was devised by David and Tom back in 1999. And the reason why I can be so specific about the year is I was recovering from emergency surgery in September, and David very kindly offered me a place on the rota of guides for the new walk. I was so grateful to him because it gave me something positive to focus on when I was recovering from the surgery. So by my calculation, the walk is over 20 years old, a cause for celebration indeed. And I remember David meeting me at the underground station, walking me through the route, and giving me suggestions as to possible stopping places and subjects and topics to include in the walk. So I went home, I did the research, prepared the material, and joined the Rota of Guides sometime in 2020. Over the years, I've made some modifications to the walk. In response both to comments and feedback from walkers, and my own practical experience of guiding the walk. But largely, during the 11 years or so that I guided the walk, it remained the same. Every guide will present their own version of the old Marylebone Walk, while remaining faithful to the overview description given in the brochure. But on my walk, I included topics such as discussing the origins of the name Marylebone and how you pronounce it. Is it, for example, Marylebone or Marylebone? Pointing out some interesting architectural features on Stratford Place, the site of the Lord Mayor of London's banqueting house at one time. Plaques to commemorate Octavia Hill, the housing reformer, and Michael Faraday, the great scientist. The site of the church, which gave its name to the district, which is now a delightful public garden, but when previously a churchyard, included among its burials George Stubbs, the famous horse painter, and Charles Wesley, the great hymn writer. I discussed the way in which Marylebone Lane twists and turns, distinguishing itself from the grid-like layout of most of the district, and explain the reason why. I would also take walkers past the church where Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning, the famous poets, married secretly in 1846. Close to the church was a mural on a wall of a building which marked the site of one of Charles Dickens' London residences. And the mural shows characters from the novels which Charles Dickens wrote while living at this address. It was always great fun identifying the characters with the walkers and matching them to the correct novel. For me, the most challenging part of the walk was leading walkers along Moxon Street, past one of the most celebrated cheese stores in the country, La Fromagerie. I was convinced that one day there would be on the walk those whose passion for cheese equaled mine for London and its history, and they would not be able to resist the temptation, lured by the mouth-watering sights and smells of the cheeses on display, of crossing the shop's threshold and abandoning completely the old Marylebone Walk. Then, as the walk was drawing to its conclusion, we would enter the magnificent Regent's Park, named after the Prince Regent, future King George IV, arguably the most varied of all the London parks, for it's home to the open-air theatre, to London Zoo, to the Regent's Park Canal, the Regent's Park Mosque, the Queen Mary Rose Gardens, which have over 12,000 roses and 85 single variety beds. And my favourite place of all in the park are the so-called secret gardens, which are the public gardens of the private St John's Lodge. St John's Lodge is just one of the two remaining villas from the 8 originally built in the park, designed to give aristocrats a country villa in an urban setting. And the house is still owned by Prince Geoffrey of Brunei, whose family bought the property in 1994 for £40 million. And while the gardens may not be that secret anymore, they still remain one of the hidden gems of London, very popular in particular among local residents who go there to read or paint or simply enjoy the beauty and tranquility of these delightful gardens, which are accessed along an alleyway with a wisteria-clad tunnel. Now, on the old Marylebone Walk, time only permitted us to enter the park and point out a few notable features. But I went on to devise, subsequently, a repertory walk whose route followed a section of the Regent's Park scheme, talked about its background and development, and spent much more time exploring the delights of the park itself. But on the old Marylebone Walk, we would conclude by taking in the view of the splendid John Nash terraces, designed to provide for the park both privacy and grandeur. And finally, having talked much on the walk about one of the lost rivers of London, which is now largely culverted underground, we'd see where it manifests itself in the form of the lake in Regent's Park. Now, in order to guarantee that the walk would prove to be a huge success, David and Tom included a stop which elevated it from the category of fascinating and excellent to unforgettable and unmissable. And that stop was a visit to Hertford House, Manchester Square, home to the Wallace Collection. The Wallace Collection is a public national museum and one of the finest of its kind. It includes paintings, furniture, objets d'art, arms and armaments, Sèvres porcelain, glass, miniatures, ceramics, and sculpture. And all of these works were acquired by one family. Four generations of the Marquesses of Hertford and the illegitimate son of the fourth Marquess, Sir Richard Wallace. It was his widow, Lady Wallace, who bequeathed the entire collection and the house to the nation in 1897. And the museum opened its doors to the public in 1900. Although the first three Marquesses did make contributions to the collection, the bulk of it was acquired by the fourth Marquess and his son. And so it very much reflects their personal tastes, particularly in the field of French art and furniture of the 18th century. Now, once again, every guide on the old Marylebone Walk will show different features of the collection. And my choice was to show some of the famous paintings on display. Most of them acquired by the fourth Marquess of Hertford. And a common reaction I found among the walkers, who'd either never heard of the Wallace Collection, or who had heard of it but never visited the museum, was astonishment to find paintings that they recognised on display, such as Franz Hals' The Laughing Cavalier, or Poussin's Dance to the Music of Time. Or they might not recognise a specific painting, but they'd certainly recognise the artist, because there are works here by Titian, Rubens, Rembrandt, Canaletto, Gainsborough, to name but a few. And the reason why the painting collection is so superlative is because the fourth Marquess of Hertford, who acquired most of it, was a great connoisseur of the arts and passionate about his subject. And he was also fabulously wealthy. And that combination guaranteed huge successes in the auction room. Some of his triumphs were legendary. Take, for example, The Rainbow Landscape by Peter Paul Rubens, dating to around 1636. Now, we normally associate Rubens with paintings of a historical, classical, biblical, or allegorical subject matter, and paintings which project a powerful image of the state or monarchy. Take, for example, the ceiling paintings for the Banqueting House of Whitehall, commissioned by King Charles I. And in particular, paintings of ladies with lots and lots and lots of layers of flesh. So much so that we've coined the phrase Rubenesque to refer to a lady with a voluptuous figure. But these were the paintings that Rubens did to commission. When he went into semi-retirement, he never fully gave up his professional work. He could paint for pleasure, and the genre of his choice was landscape. When Rubens was 53 years old, he married for a second time. The 16-year-old Elena Fourmont, so 37 years his junior. But Rubens admitted he wasn't yet ready for the celibate life, and he proved the point. The couple had five children, the youngest of whom was born after Rubens' death. In 1635, he bought the estate of Hetstein near Antwerp. With the estate went the title of Lord of the Manor of Hetstein and a house grand enough to match the title. A three-storied, gable-windowed, turreted building, complete with a lookout tower, bridge, moat, and impressive gated doorway. And Rubens spent the summer months of the five remaining years of his life at his country estate, indulging in his twin passions of family life and landscape painting. And what makes the landscape paintings of Rubens so special is that they're the autographed work of the artist. In other words, they are his work and his work alone. Now, in his professional career, Rubens had a large workshop of assistants working under him. He would take overall charge and responsibility of the project and delegate certain parts of it to his assistants. This enabled him to undertake a large number of commissions, some quite complex in terms of scope and execution. And this helps account, aside from him being one of the greatest artists of all time, for his huge financial success. It helps explain how he was able to buy a house as impressive as Hetstein and the land and title that went with it. By contrast, with these landscape paintings, he was painting for pure pleasure, had no assistants at all. And these landscape paintings reflect an artist working at the height of his genius and artistic powers. He was able to pour his passion and love of the countryside into these works and draw upon a lifetime of experience in developing these skills, in rendering so beautifully the different elements of the countryside, the animals, the plants, the flowers, the trees, the meadows, the cloud formations, the subtle changes in light shown at different times of the day, all of these which he incorporated as background in many of his narrative works. Here, they take centre stage, and rightly so. Now, the two largest of Rubens' landscape paintings, an autumn landscape with a view of Hetstein in the early morning, and the rainbow landscape, both dating to around 1636, have always been regarded as companion pieces. They're both massive, the morning scene being 131 by 229 centimetres, and the rainbow landscape, 135 by 235 centimetres, so both over 7 feet long. And the medium is oil on oak wood panels. The reason we know for sure that these works were intended for private pleasure is to do with the frames. They both consist of over a dozen pieces of Bavarian oak wood. High quality, but offcuts, probably discarded pieces in the studio. Technical analysis has revealed that both paintings were done in three distinct stages, working from the centre outwards. And Rubens employed a panelist to enlarge the frame as he added details to each painting. And this practice of constructing a panel from different pieces of material of oak wood and enlarging it as you went along would certainly not have been acceptable to private patrons. Let's take a brief look at both paintings. an autumn landscape with a view of Hechtstein in the early morning, is in the National Gallery in London. So if you look at the National Gallery's excellent website, you'll find a very clear image of the painting. The painting was acquired by the National Gallery in 1826. In this superb painting, we are given a breathtaking bird's-eye panoramic view of the countryside surrounding Hechtstein, which is shown on the left-hand side of the picture. It's early morning. The sun shown on the right-hand side is still very low on the sky, but its rays are strong enough to tinge the dispersing clouds with a golden yellow, to gild the foliage of the trees and shrubs, cause the dew in the meadows to glisten, and the windows of Hechtstein to sparkle. Rubens presents us with a traditional way of showing distance in landscape. There are three horizontal bands of colour. Reds and browns for the foreground, greens and golds for the middle distance, and blue to represent the hazy far distance. And on the horizon, we can make out the outline of buildings which represent the settlement of Malines, now known as Mechelen. We're invited by Rubens to spend time with this glorious landscape and its inhabitants, which are brought to life by the morning sun. We note the hunter in the foreground with his gun and his faithful hound, stalking the partridges in the meadow beyond and taking advantage of the concealment provided for him by the gnarled stump of an old tree, rendered with such meticulous detail by Rubens. And to the left of the hunter, we note a peasant couple, probably husband and wife, driving a horse and cart through a stream on their way to market. The husband sits on one of the horses, driving it forward, and behind him, in the cart, sits his wife, enthroned like queen of the castle upon her pile of goods. She beams a broad smile from beneath her bonnet, with her brass milk jug by her side and a calf by her feet, on its back, with its legs in the air, tied together, no doubt in preparation for sale at market. Beyond the partridges is a rickety bridge crossing one of the many streams that divide the meadows, leading to one of the fields where the milkmaids are already busy at work. One of the maids has gathered up her blue skirts as she walks barefooted through the grass. The other, wearing a pinky red skirt, is seated on a stool with her head resting against the side of a cow that she's busy milking. We take in a view of the gabled windows and turrets and lookout tower of Hechtstein and its bridge and moat and impressive gated doorway. But it takes us longer for us to notice the young boy with a fishing rod leaning rather precariously over the bridge, no doubt hoping that he'll catch some large fish for breakfast. Then to the left of the doorway, we see the lord and lady of the manor enjoying a morning stroll in the sunshine. So probably a self-portrait of Rubens and his wife. The woman seated on the grass next to them is probably the nursemaid, cradling a baby on her knee. And though the features are indistinct, we know that this is a wealthy family, because their status is betrayed by the sun, with its rays causing the silks and satins of their fine garments to shimmer and sparkle. There is so much to enjoy in this painting. It's stating the obvious, but the more time you can spend with this painting, the more pleasure you derive from the experience. Time we can spend enjoying, in particular, the contrast between areas which are rendered with meticulous detail and other areas where Rubens' brushstrokes are much more free and fluid. And our appreciation of the work has been enhanced through the recent cleaning of the painting. Layers of yellow varnish have been removed to reveal the delicacy and subtlety of Rubens' original colour scheme. The way he keenly observes, for example, the effects of the early morning sun upon the countryside and its inhabitants, and the delicate handling of the sunlight so beautifully contrasting with the rich and deep autumnal shades of the trees, flowers, leaves, and shrubs. All of these rendered with exquisite detail by the artist. Well, if that painting wasn't enough to feast the eye, Rubens gave us birthday and Christmas all rolled into one with the companion piece, The Rainbow Landscape. This is the painting that's in the Wallace Collection, so an excellent image of it can be seen on the Wallace Collection website. It's not intended to be the same day as the Hechstein picture, because this is the harvest time, so probably June or July, and it's late afternoon, judging by the length of the shadows cast by the avenue of trees on the right-hand side. As with the morning landscape, we're given a bird's-eye view of the countryside, but there is a sense that we're closer to the action this time. A cart laden with hay, possibly the same vehicle that we saw in the Hechstein picture, is being driven by a man along a dusty road. This time, the cart is going into the picture. In the Hechstein painting, it was coming out towards us. The driver's destination is the field ahead on the left-hand side, where harvesters, bathed in sunlight, are busy making haystacks. They've resumed their work after an enforced break due to a thunderstorm. The driver passes by two milkmaids who are walking along the path in our direction. One of the ladies, wearing a red top and white cap and apron, appears to be exchanging a greeting with him. The other young milkmaid, wearing a blue dress, is being propositioned by a rather scruffy-looking man holding a pitchfork. He's trying his luck with the lady, but clearly he's not succeeding. She ignores him, looking towards us confidently smiling, with her hand placed on her hip as she moves forward towards us. One of the milk jugs is slung over her shoulder, the other tied by straps to her head. Next to the milkmaids is a herd of cattle being driven forward by the herdsman, and he's trying to bring back into the group one or two who have strayed. Tempted by the opportunity to take refreshment at the stream, their bodies beautifully reflected in the still waters. To the right of the cattle we have another group of animals, in this case, ducks, bathed in a pool of sunlight, engaged in very duck-like activities, preening themselves, bathing in the sunlight, flapping about their wings, quacking loudly, and taking refreshment at the water's edge. And unlike the cattle, which have been painted with meticulous attention to detail, these creatures have been painted with the freedom and economy of brushwork that is simply astonishing. Just a few strokes of the brush applied directly to the panel, and yet Rubens has accurately recorded for us the appearance and the movement of the ducks. And an even freer style of brushwork has been used to render the pair of horses running free and wild in the fields beyond the stream to the right-hand side of the avenue of trees. It's literally just a few flicks of the wrist which have created the joyous movement of the running horses and reflecting the confidence of an artist who is literally at the height of his powers. The avenue of trees, their tops beautifully gilded by the glorious rays of the afternoon sun, are presented to us in a wedge-like shape, the size of the trees receding as we look further into the distance. And it's one of a number of strong diagonal lines that serve that purpose of bringing us into the countryside and looking as far into the distance as possible. And as we're brought further into the painting, our eyes are brought up to its crowning glory, the double rainbow. The dazzling sunshine that's followed the thunderstorm, indicated by the still threatening grey clouds, make its appearance seem almost inevitable. Painting a rainbow was one of the great artistic challenges. To capture convincingly an image that was so transient, so fleeting in its nature. but Rubens was happy to take up the gauntlet. He once said, "My talent is such that no undertaking, no matter how vast in size, has ever surpassed my courage." So he takes up the challenge and succeeds with flying colours. Once again, he uses a very free style to achieve this glorious image. But for Rubens, it wasn't so much a matter of his being able to show off his technical prowess. For him, the rainbow was a reflection of his deep faith. It's always had strong biblical associations, most notably as the rainbow sent by God to represent a new covenant with his people after the great flood. Rubens wasn't just a great artist, he was also a highly skilled, experienced, and accomplished diplomat. He had spent much of his life negotiating peace treaties between warring European countries. Seeing only too well the devastation that war had caused his own country, the Netherlands. He'd even received a knighthood from both King Charles I of Britain and King Philip IV of Spain for negotiating a peace treaty between the two countries. So these paintings are not just a celebration of the countryside. They also reflect Rubens' passionate belief, particularly the rainbow landscape painting, that when men and women live peaceably together, prosperity, goodwill, and happiness will flourish. When there is that perfect harmony achieved between God and humans and nature, when the countryside is used for the benefit of all and the exploitation of none, and when that perfect harmony and balance is achieved, then the sun shines even more brilliantly, more benevolently upon the countryside and its inhabitants, and rainbows appear in the sky. So these paintings are particularly special because they don't just express Rubens' love of the countryside, they also reflect his deepest convictions and faith. Now it's thought that the two paintings were hung in a room in Hechtstein, facing each other, with a window in between. So in the morning, the sun would come in through the window, illuminating the morning scene to best effect. And then in the afternoon, the rainbow landscape likewise. Even after Rubens' death in 1640, the paintings were kept together. And this remained the situation until 1803, when the paintings were brought to London by a consortium of art dealers, and then they went their separate ways. In 1826, the National Gallery in London acquired the autumn landscape with a view of Hechtstein in the early morning. And so when the rainbow landscape came up for auction in 1856, the National Gallery, under the directorship of Sir Charles Eastlake, were very keen to acquire the painting so the two works could be reunited once again. But they were unsuccessful in their attempt because they were outbid by the 4th Marquess of Hertford, who admitted that he didn't care for Rubens' landscapes, but he knew that it was an important picture, so he wanted to acquire it. No doubt, his satisfaction at outbidding the National Gallery and acquiring the painting exceeded his appreciation of the work. He never saw it. He simply ordered it to be sent direct to Hertford House, Manchester Square. So sadly, the opportunity to reunite the two paintings was lost in 1856. However, thanks to the terms of the Wallace Bequest in 1897, the rainbow landscape became the property of the nation, and like the Hechtstein painting in the National Gallery, can be seen free of charge. So we can now see both paintings, albeit in different locations. However, last year, the public had the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see for a short time the two paintings reunited for the first time in over 200 years. Now, under its original terms, the Wallace Collection was not seen as a lending or borrowing institution, but the rules and regulations have been relaxed in recent times to make the lending and borrowing of works permissible. The Wallace Collection, loaned to the National Gallery, its painting of Titian's Perseus and Andromeda, for a special exhibition at the National Gallery, which reunited all the Poesie works by Titian for the very first time. In exchange for this loan, they were lent by the National Gallery the Hechtdane picture. So the paintings, always seen as companion pictures, were reunited for a short time. In preparation for its journey to the exhibition at the Wallace Collection, the National Gallery painting was cleaned, all the yellow varnish was removed, its panels were reinforced, and both pictures were presented with new frames based on 17th century models. And these replaced the 19th century frames, which were not suitable for the oak panels. In the exhibition room, the paintings were hung facing each other, with plenty of space in between for the viewer to stand and get a truly immersive experience of these great works of art. Works which had a profound impact on the British artist John Constable and many of the Impressionist artists too. Well, sadly, the exhibition only lasted a few months and Hechtdane has been returned to the National Gallery. However, on the Wallace Collection website, there is a huge amount of information about the exhibition. You can see images of how the paintings looked when on display. And Lucy Davis, who curated the exhibition, has published a companion guide, which gives much more detailed information about the artist and these two superb works of art. So the purchase of the Rainbow Landscape by the 4th Marquess of Hertford in 1856 represented one of his legendary triumphs in the auction room, but not the most celebrated. That honour is bestowed on one of two paintings which the 4th Marquess acquired in 1865, which are now regarded as the most celebrated in the Wallace Collection and among the most famous paintings in the world. And in part two of my podcast, I'll be discussing the first of those acquisitions, which is arguably the most iconic and famous painting in the Wallace Collection. So I hope very much to enjoy your company for part two of my talk. Have a lovely week, Happy New Year, and goodbye.